This is an ABC podcast.
The Sydney Writers' Festival always has a great buzz, and most years we bring you a live conversation from on-site at the festival. Last year, I broadcast live with the very entertaining American writer Andrew Sean Greer. His novel Less had recently won the Pulitzer Prize. The only thing was, so many of you were there to see Andy, and so many people were in the next room listening to another writer at the same time, and these two rooms were only separated by a red velvet curtain. So to begin with, it was kind of noisy and a little bit crazy. To be honest, it was one of those high adrenaline live radio experiences that I think will stay with both Andy and myself. But hearing Andy's story was also a lot of fun, and he has some surprising reflections on family and relationships. I hope you enjoy it. Here's Andrew Sean Greer from last year's Sydney Writers' Festival.
Hey, Andy, welcome.
Thank you so much.
What sort of place is Rockville, Maryland, where you grew up?
Rockville, Maryland, that's where I grew up. It is sort of, if you think of a Steven Spielberg movie where the kids are on bicycles and there's little houses that all look like each other, that's where I grew up, yeah.
So a safe place, a happy place?
It was, yeah, I loved it until I was 12 and then I realized it was nowhere. So I was dying to get out, but it was good till 12. Yeah, it was very sweet.
In those years before 12, when you were living in a street next to houses that all looked pretty much the same, were all the families pretty similar? Was your family similar to the people next door?
My family was the only not Jewish family in the whole neighborhood. So I grew up celebrating Passover and Hanukkah, and when it was bar mitzvah time, I was very confused why everybody else got a party, and I didn't, so my parents threw me like a faux mitzvah. And my brother, I have a twin brother too, you know, without the Hebrew and the rabbi, but just with the DJ, you know, because I felt a little left out.
Tell me about growing up with a twin. How big a part of your identity was it as a kid to have a twin?
I didn't realize till later that most people grow up, first of all, annoying their parents who were trying to get them to play with them because they have no one else to play with. And then I've always had someone who agreed with me about absolutely everything all the time.
Really?
Yeah, so it gives you a kind of confidence that you're like, you know, you don't like playing Twister, neither do I. That's a bad game. No argument, you know? It's done.
You had a mirror image just validating your every preference.
Yeah, we're still incredibly similar. We used to live until very recently, and we had adjoining houses with that shared a backyard. If you can picture Victorians in San Francisco with like a tiny little backyard, we lived together basically until he had two kids and had to get like a bigger place 10 blocks away, which was a little heartbreaking because I loved the idea of just living right next to each other.
So growing up, you're identical. Does that mean you ever play tricks on parents or teachers?
We were very good boys. We won one time on April Fool's Day in sixth grade, so we were like 11 or 12 years old. We switched outfits because at that point we had really distinctive outfits. My brother would wear a white button-up Oxford and carry a briefcase, and I looked normal. So we switched classrooms, I remember it really well. It was terrifying because everyone thought I was him. They didn't take anything at all. I sat at his desk and the teacher started asking me questions. And then I carried it through until the door between the classrooms opened up and my brother was being taken through by my teacher because he had failed completely. We never did it again because it was scary.
Well, so you say, but I'm just not 100% sure that we have the right Greer twin with us today at the Sydney Writers' Festival, but I guess we'll just ask you the questions and see how we go.
I try to get him to show up to things that I can't go to as recently as last month, and he will not do it. I don't know why. Yeah.
Were there a lot of books in your house when you were growing up, Andy?
Yeah. My parents both grew up in the rural South in America, places called Kentucky, South Carolina, which probably brings up like horse ranches and shacks and country ham and that kind of thing. And their parents were like, you know, butchers, seamstresses, but they both had access to libraries, which is how they sort of saw a world outside of that. My dad taught himself German from his father's World War II emergency kit. You know, if you were parachuted in behind enemy lines and you had like a German-English dictionary and like a chewing gum, chocolate, you know, some strange kit. So my dad taught himself German from that.
I imagine it was fairly specific vocabulary, like don't shoot, take me back.
I wish he had it. I know. I think it was super practical. Like, you know, like, what is the way out of here? Something like that.
Please.
And then my mother taught herself chemistry from books. And so to them, books were the most amazing thing in the world because they were the way out. My parents both became chemistry professors. And they let me and my brother, our library was all together, children's books and adults' books, and they let us pick up anything. They said, nothing in here is going to hurt you. So we would read some pretty adult books.
Why, what were the racier books on the bookshelf?
The Kama Sutra seemed pretty racy, but like, I feel that didn't hurt me.
So you were saying that Rockville was a great place till you were about 12. What changed when you were a teenager?
Well, I started going to a school. Rockville is outside of Washington, D.C. And I started going to school in Washington, D.C. And then I met City Kids. And City Kids were, this is the 80s, so they were like punk rock. They were listening to, you know, outrageous vinyl 45s that they older brothers gave them. And I was so uncool that I was like, I gotta get some sort of, you know, they were like Almodovar films, and they would dress in vintage clothes, and that was so foreign, and I wanted to be part of it, and you couldn't do that from Rockville.
Is there a part of your education in coolness, maybe, Andy, that you missed at crucial years?
I have had no education in coolness. I've been so cool for so long that I now feel like I'm on top of it. You know? Like, if you just stay nerdy for long enough, you come into style.
When you moved away to college, how did your way of presenting yourself, how did your look start to change?
Oh, well, it was bad at first. I remember a friend I made in college, when I told him I was from Rockville, Maryland, he said, now I understand why you dress the way you do. Which now I recall I was, you know, I bought a sweatshirt with my college's name on it, which I thought is what you do in college, but it was not the cool thing to do, I guess.
But it probably is now, as you say, it's probably circled round.
Oh, if I wore it now, it'd be super cool.
So you say that both your parents were scientists and really self-motivated into the world of science. How did that shape the way they parented you and your brother, do you think?
They were very practically minded. My dad was a theoretical chemist, and my mother was, until recently, an experimental chemist, which really puts them at odds. One is more practical than the other one. My dad would take me on long walks, and we would talk about the nature of the universe and black holes and two dimensions and three dimensions and one dimension and four dimensions. But I have a strong memory of walking with my mother, the experimental chemist, and saying, Mom, why is the sky blue? And she said, honey, that's not my field. I'm like five or something.
After college or at college, you went home for Thanksgiving in 1989. What conversation did you have with your mom and dad?
Okay, I had come out to myself as gay in college, somewhere at the end of freshman year, and I made a lot of friends. And at that time, nobody was out in the United States. You know, young people, celebrities, anybody. But there was a movement to that everybody had to come out so that people would see that gay people lived among them and would have some sort of feeling of empathy and love, because we were in the AIDS crisis where we were watching lack of empathy in a large way. And so we all vowed we were going to go home over Christmas break, come out to our parents, come back, and we would have saved the world. And so mine went really well. I came out to my family over the, not Christmas table. My memory apparently is wrong. My mother remembers it better, and you'll see why. I came out to them, and they were nice about it.
Were they surprised, or?
No. They were shocked, not surprised. You know, it was not what they thought I was going to say, but they weren't surprised by what I said. I mean, you can see it coming a long way.
You discovered that there was a book that your father had his collection. Yeah. What was that?
Well, I have to say, my parents took me, who are lovely people, but it was the 1970s, took me to a therapist when I was 3 years old because I was drawing a family picture with my mother, my father, a little boy and a little girl, and the little girl was me. And that really confused them. So they bought a book that I discovered years later called Growing Up Straight. And
like a manual?
Like a manual. There were parts for what to do about boys and what to do about girls. And the parts of what to do about boys, it was go camping. The father should go camping with the son and teach him mumbledy-peg.
I'm sorry?
Mumbledy-peg is where you throw a knife at like a log, you know? Which is not a gesture that's going to help out, really. That kind of thing. You know, cooking potatoes in a fire.
Have your dad done this sort of stuff with you?
It was my whole childhood had been underlined in the book. My dad had dutifully, as a scientist, done everything he'd been told to do. You know, go to Civil War memorials and look for, you know, bullets and arrowheads and that stuff. And I had such fond memories that it actually didn't spoil it for me. I was like, well, that was really sweet, you know?
So they had an inkling, you finally confirmed things, and after that conversation, where did you take off to in the car?
I went to the mall, which was in Rockville, Maryland, the only place to go, you know, like, I'm not sure, I was returning Christmas presents, I think, which seems ungracious of me, looking back. And of course, being a teenager, I locked myself out of the car, called home in, a payphone, and my mom came to pick me up. And she opened the car and then she got in the car with me and she said, I know you told us that you're gay tonight. Honey, I think I am too. Which was the best news I had ever heard.
Was it a surprise?
No. I knew. In some way, I was not surprised at all. It's sort of like if your parent says, I'm Spider-Man. And you're like, that explains everything. You know, you're shocked, but you're like, wow, okay.
What did it explain about your mom?
Hanging out with the women's studies department a lot, I would say. Explain that. Some different clothing.
So did your mom know many other gay women?
She started to. But she didn't at that time because there was no internet. There's no way to sort of connect. And so, but, you know, she was at a university. So this was at a moment when there was starting to be women's studies departments. And the feminist movement from the 70s has made itself into academia. And students were interested in talking about this. And so there, it was possible for there to be out lesbian professors somewhat. It was not great for my mom to be an out lesbian as a chemistry professor in a male-dominated world that was already not cool with her.
So back in that car in outside the mall in Rockville, Maryland, where there is this revelation, I guess, that you've shared, you've heard, did she then go and tell your dad straight away?
Well, she did say, don't tell your dad. Yeah. Yeah. He wasn't quite ready for that. I think that took 6 months, maybe, for her to tell him.
So you had that as a secret?
Yeah. I didn't tell my brother. And I guess it's bad to make your kids hold secrets like that. But I was 19. And at that time, I think when you come out for the first time, everything gay seems fabulous. Like, you'll wear rainbow anything, and you watch RuPaul's Drag Race constantly. It's all fabulous. So having a gay mom is just felt like amazing. What could be better? And it took me a while to realize, like, oh, they're divorcing. I guess that's what happens. Yeah.
How did your mom use your coming out as a kind of litmus test for her own coming out?
Again, my family's from the rural South, Southern Baptists. You may not have that here.
We have a version.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where they don't allow drinking because it might lead to dancing, you know. So my mom would tell each of her relatives one by one that I was gay to kind of see how that went.
And if it was what went well, she'd PS?
No, she didn't add that on for a long time. She sort of let my news percolate out, have everyone kind of soften it all up, and then if you don't talk about it, it isn't happening.
Did she feed back to you how people had responded, you know, your relatives, your neighbours? Did you get the information coming back your way?
Well, I hadn't known she was doing this, I have to say. Like, I love her very much, and I think it was a wise choice on her part. But it was interesting that the, you know, like, the Coopersteins learned before I was ready for the Coopersteins to know.
Who were the Coopersteins?
They were our best friends down the street growing up, and Myrna Cooperstein was like a second mother to me. But, you know, I would have liked to tell her because she was so hilarious. I think she would have had a hilarious response. But I didn't get... My mom did it first.
If you, you know, looking back, Andy, do you think if you hadn't come out at that point, would your mom have had the courage herself?
I wonder. She would have. You know, she's a really strong woman. And I think that the times had changed enough that something that was impossible even to consider for her as like a woman going to a women's college in the 1960s where you wore white gloves and, you know, went to church on Sunday. It was unspeakable, and so she just kept it down. And then suddenly the world changed enough where I don't think it was me. She'd clearly been thinking about it a long time. If she said it hours after I said it to her, she would have come out. Maybe not as openly, because I was totally out and open. And that might have given her... We sort of held each other's hands for that stuff. I went on dates with her, too. Yeah. Yeah, it was great.
So what happened in her life next? I mean, did she find a relationship?
Yeah, she did. Yeah, yeah. A woman who she's been with for 20, 30, 35 years, something like that. Yeah, yeah.
And what about your dad? How did he cope with this reconfiguration of his family?
Oh, I remember going, we had family therapy. Oh, my God. Thanks for bringing it up. And my dad is a really sweet, lovely, gentle man. And I remember at family therapy where the therapist said, "And Bill, do you have anything to say?" And he said, "Well, I would like everyone to know that I am not gay." That's the world we are in now. The default is gay. So if you need to come out, tell your parents you're straight. They'll be okay about it. It was funny he felt that way. My brother's not gay either, but he is very sissy, so I see why he might think that.
After college, Andy, your adventures took you to Montana. What were you doing there?
Oh, my God. Well, what happened was I moved to New York City with friends from college, and I couldn't hack it. That was way too big a city for me. It was way too cool. Yeah, it was all the cool kids. And then there I was, not cool at all, not making any money. And, like, it was a gritty city at that time.
Well, what kind of things were you doing for work in New York?
Oh, I was a chauffeur for celebrities, of all things, for a TV show, Saturday Night Live. I would chauffeur the writers around New York City. Isn't that weird?
Did you
I was driving in New York City? It doesn't seem good. Yeah.
Did you see things in that car that were surprising?
No, they were writers. There's nothing going
they
on.
They sat morosely in the corner and...
No, they would chat. Yeah, we'd listen to the radio. It was pretty fun. And some of them had been around a long, long time, had worked on TV shows in the 60s. And I realize now that I was meeting people who had been important in comedy long before. Like a woman, Marilyn Miller, I think was her name, who worked on Mary Tyler Moore Show as a female writer. It was an honor to be able to drive her around. Yeah.
In Montana, though, were you able to move into the cool set in Montana?
Oh, thank God. No one was cool. I was so cool in Montana. And I moved to Montana because I applied to a graduate program, any graduate program that would get me out of New York City. And I got into two. I got into the University of Alabama and University of Montana. So I had to choose the bayou or the mountains.
And you chose the mountains. What was it like living there?
It was fantastic. It was fantastic. It was good for me. I had been in a world where all my friends were gay. I was living in the West Village, which at the time was a super gay part of New York City. Gay, 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 gay. And I moved to a small town in the Rocky Mountains in the northwest of the United States near the Canadian border where people would say, "I've never met a gay person before. What it's like? What is it like for you?" And I didn't realize that I was a novelty. And I had to sort of reassess how I met new people, you know? They would take me camping, and it wasn't in order to make me straight. It's because that's what you did. And I had to, like, figure it out. It was good for me. I un-New Yorkized myself, you know?
And how determined were you to make it as a writer in this period, Andy? Was it a real focus?
I think it was obsessive determination.
Where did that come from?
I don't know. I think naivete. It's got to be, I was just so certain that if I gave up for, relaxed for a second, that I would give it all up. Because I'd seen it happen in other graduate students who had, they would graduate, they would stay in Montana, they'd get a job at the sandwich shop, and they wouldn't write anymore. And I was writing diligently, late at night, that kind of thing, and I had heard somewhere that if you get, you need to get 200 rejections for your writing before you will get an acceptance. And so I would send these in the mail out to magazines, and I would make a file with all the rejection letters, and I got almost exactly 200 before I got published. Yeah.
What was it that you wanted so badly? Why did you have that determination?
Oh my God, no one's asked me that before. It's what I wanted to be so badly. And all I wanted was the permission to do it. You know, I think when you're young, you, as a writer, it's why you're always wanting people to read your stuff, because you want to know, like, am I allowed to make all the sacrifices and force people around me to make sacrifices for this absurd dream? And I wondered that until about a year ago, I have to say, you know.
What kind of stories were you writing and submitting to magazines?
Oh, they were not good. Yeah, it's not like I was an undiscovered talent or something like that. I was not sure what I wanted to be, but I wanted to be clever. I wanted to be cool and super clever. So I would write science fiction stories. There was a time where I thought I would be a science fiction writer. I sent them to like Isaac Asimov's World of Science Fiction magazine and that kind of stuff, robot stories. And then I also, once in a while, for class, would write super realistic fiction, and I would roll my eyes thinking, well, this is what they want, you know? And it was to my great sadness that I discovered that I was not clever or cool or a very good science fiction writer, that I was good at the realistic stuff, you know?
How much of a struggle was it financially?
Yeah, that was the hardest part. I mean, that's always the hardest part for any artist to figure it out, especially when you're super young, which is why I was, you know, I would take any job. I worked for Nintendo for a while in Seattle. I was a game tester. That's a pretty good job. Yeah. I would teach at the community college. You know, I helped out a catering friend of mine, but it was always super, super broke. And so I learned how to cook. I always tell my students, I give them a book of recipes for cheap things that will last all week.
Because, well, what were you eating? What was in your on your menu in those years?
It was a lot of tuna fish. It was a tuna fish sandwich every day for lunch for about 10 years. I still love them. Tastes like freedom.
So... did all of this struggle miraculously change once you did publish your first book?
No. Because there's still no money. And there's also something about publishing that I think you think it's going to happen and God will come down. This is a Southern Baptist in me, and say, well done, my good and faithful servant. The future path is before you, golden and lit with sun. And instead, nothing happens. You know, silence, there was no internet, so you don't even know if anyone's reading it. And so then you just sort of go on and spend your advance on your rent for about 6 months and wonder what next.
Did you get reviews in that first book?
I did. It was a book of short stories. And a lot of the reviews were in the gay press. So, you know, there's these little magazines about things that are happening this week, and it's like Leather Sunday, you know, and kind of, you know, Foam Party, I don't know. And then it would be like new book by, you know, Andrew Sean Greer. And I don't think that sold very many books, because it's not a Foam Party kind of book.
This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Andy, you were describing how those early years of being a writer were incredibly tough financially and professionally, and what sort of determination and forbearance, I guess, you had to display to keep going. Tell me how your writing took you to Italy.
That was a great change in my life too. I had a novel, my third book, called The Confessions of Max Tivoli, and it was a surprise hit, thank God, you know. That was a wonderful change for me, and it brought me to the attention of the Baronessa, and I got an email, there was email by this time, from a Baronessa saying, I would be honored if you would come to my writer's retreat in Tuscany for 6 weeks. Thank you for joining me, Beatrice Monti della Corte von Rizzori.
So a real-life proper baroness.
Is there a proper baroness? Yeah. She's a baronessa twice over. She married a baron as well as being born a baronessa. So I went to this place outside of Florence, an hour outside of Florence. I didn't know anything about it. And
what does it look like as you arrive?
It looks like nothing at all. That's how what good taste it is. It's an ivy-colored wall. There's sort of a large door with a lion's head knocker on it, and you don't enter that way. No one ever enters. Once a year it's opened. You enter through the little kitchen door where there's a pug scratching at the glass.
So in terms of the landscape, is it sort of the Tuscany we see in movies?
It's that. More flowers. A lot of flowers. She spent a lot of time. She always said she wishes she could afford a gardener, but she did an excellent job. And it's really not like a grand villa. It was just, it was an old house that farmers had used where they would sleep above and then the sheep would be below, and that she had transformed in the 70s, I think, into a place for her and her husband to live. And they had bought a nearby medieval tower, as you do, and restored that.
What sort of personality was this, or is this baroness?
She is a 93, and she's a vibrant one still. She is a forceful woman. I think she's of the generation from World War II, where you got through it, you know, doing anything you could. And she made herself into sort of an art expert of Italy. She introduced abstract expressionism into Southern Europe. It's great fun to talk to her, because you just try to get her to name drop, which she won't do, but she accidentally will be, say, like, okay, and then Gregory Peck, of course, took me to the movies every Sunday. I was out doing acid with Harrison Ford and David Bowie. You know, it's all, she was part of all of it. But she's a gallerist, not an artist, so she's interested in connecting artists together and seeing what will happen, even if something bad happens. She loves it.
Well, if you are lucky enough to be invited to this writer's retreat, what are your obligations once you arrive there? What do you need to do?
You just need to be in your room and write, but you do have to show up for lunch and dinner. And you have to dress for dinner, and you have to learn how to be at a table.
And what did that involve?
Well, I became the director of this place, so I would have to lead the writers into how to do that, which is what proper conversation is at the table. Like, if you have a table of Americans in Italy, they will sit and talk about mosquito repellent and what brand is best. And that is not what the Baronessa is interested in hearing about. It's not that she doesn't want sort of ribald topics. She would love those. She doesn't want anything boring. And if it's boring, she'll pretend she can't understand you, which happened with a few Australian writers who came. My favorite one was a writer, Abigail Ullman, who's fantastic, from Melbourne. And the Baronessa claimed never to understand anything she said. Abby would tell a story, and Beatrice would say, I'm sure you've said something very interesting. And at the end, Abby said, you know, I'm going to call you. I'm in New York. And Beatrice said, well, at least I will know it's you. I think they just didn't get along very well.
Andy, but you'd gone there originally on a writer's retreat. How did you end up working for her?
because it changed my life. It changed a lot of people's lives. I mean, Zadie Smith was really influenced by it, and Michael Cunningham and Colm Toybean and lots of writers, because it's a sort of entry into the global world of literature. That's a silly thing to say, global world. But I became aware how parochial I was as American, only reading American writers, only knowing like the bestsellers and not knowing the past, not knowing Italian, Egyptian writers, and watching the look of the Baronessa being appalled that I didn't know of these things and trying to catch up on my homework, not knowing the history of art. And then also in some way, she is a link to the 19th century. And then you realize that you have access to this sort of trove of knowledge that you would never come across. And a lot of writers, if they can get past this sort of Baronessa-ness, then you've got a good story in there somewhere. And that's what you really want. Every writer got something out of her.
Did you go on shopping trips with her?
Oh, yes. You would think she would want to go to the fanciest places. But she liked to go to La Formica, which means the ant, which was a shop run by nuns in a nearby town. It was open Friday and Saturday from 4 to 7. And we had a long, rocky road to get there. And sometimes we didn't have enough gas, but we would always go.
What would be sold at La Formica?
Italians, they give up pretty fancy clothes to the nuns. And everything was a euro. So writers would arrive without the proper clothing for dinner. And I would take them to La Formica, get them dressed up in Prada and Gucci. And then they would look fine for the rest of the trip.
And just remember not to talk about mosquito repellent, and all was good.
No, the Baronessa loved a fashion show. So we would buy all kinds of stuff. And then at the end of the trip, I would take it from them and return it to La Formica.
You say that she had a beautiful garden. How did she start teaching you about gardening?
Yeah, this was the thing. The idea was that I was going to take over from her because she knew that she was probably statistically failing, although there was no evidence of it, and there still isn't. So she said I had to learn. It wasn't about reading writers. What I had to learn, it feels like Karate Kid or something, where you learn to like wax a car instead of karate. I had to learn how to set a table properly, how to dress properly, more like Gary Cooper, less like Ewan McGregor, and how to trim the roses, how to prune the roses. And she gave me a book on pruning roses in Italian and a pair of shears.
It's like your version of your dad getting the book in German, you know? You got the Italian pruning roses book in your emergency kit.
Not a lot of illustrations either. So,
what's the secret?
Well, I had her do it, of course. And someone here is an expert in pruning roses. And you have to know exactly which above which thorn or which knob to prune it. You have to be vicious. You have to have, you know, no sentimentality about it.
Tell me what happened one night in the villa when you were having dinner in April 2018.
Yeah, I had cooked dinner in my memory because Thursdays was the cook's night off, so I made ravioli mostly for the guests. And I'd also been training her pug to wear some diapers I'd ordered from China that were very chic. They had suspenders so the dog wouldn't... I was training the dog because Margaret Atwood was coming, and I thought the dog was incontinent. I didn't tell you that part of it. I thought, that's not going to do for Margaret Atwood. So I was trying to get the Baronessa used to the chic outfit and also the dog. And I had successfully done that for the evening and brought it up to the Baronessa's bed in the suspenders and went downstairs. And a friend showed me his phone that said, "Say congratulations to Andy on the Pulitzer." And I finally looked at my phone, because you don't look at your phone at dinner. That's something else, of course. And I had 150 text messages. And they were all things like, dancing lady, you know, dinosaur, fireworks, like, not very helpful. And then I had one from a lot of calls from a writer, Michael Chabon, and so who won the Pulitzer Prize, I think, in 2001. It seemed impossible this was true, but so I called him, and I said, "Michael, what is going on?" And he said, "You won the Pulitzer Prize! Am I the one telling you?" And I said, "Yeah, you're the one telling me, yeah."
Explain why the Pulitzer is such a big deal. Don't be humble. Just tell us.
Well, the other day there was a magazine saying, "What other Pulitzer Prize winners' photographs would you like next to yours?" And I said, "What do you mean?" They're like, "Hemingway, Faulkner, which would you like?" And I'm like, "Oh, crap." It's you never know why some prize has more
cachet.
Cachet than another. It's impossible to figure out. But in the United States, that one, for some reason, I think it's because it's a tiny little committee of three people. They can make some kooky choices. And they chose me. I think what's nice about it is that there isn't like a run-up with a finalist list and where you sit and are announced and then people are sort of mad at you.
Yeah.
No one gets mad because it's just a winner that's announced and then two finalists. So everyone sort of gets happy about that without the bitterness, I hope.
What did getting that phone call mean for your job with the Baroness?
It took me a while.
Is there an opening, basically, is what I'm asking, Andy. Can I send my CV?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, there is a new director. Yeah, Andrea Bajani, who is a much better director, but not a great pruner, I would guess. It took a week for me to sort of figure out what was going on. It was so shocking. And I sat her down and I said, I think I'm going to have to go. And she said, and you won't be back. And I said, no, I won't be back. And she said, you were too expensive anyway. Let us wish each other good luck. And that was she knew, because here's the thing. In her mind, I think she's like, her taste is so excellent that she chose a Pulitzer Prize winner as director and I had to leave. You know, it happens to her all the time.
Even before the judges chose.
Yes.
When it came to going to the ceremony to get your prize, what image did you have in your mind of the kind of look, the kind of suit that you'd like to have for that award?
Well, it is the most august occasion of my career. And so in my mind, I was, you know, something for Mika would not do. I wanted to order like a really sharp but subdued, austere suit that would show the seriousness of the occasion and it's important to me as a grown-up writer.
Gravitas.
Gravitas is what I was going for.
Who advised you against that look?
They're not the Baronessa. There was a writer in residence there, Terry Tempest Williams, who's an American naturalist and activist, Mormon divinity scholar, like a saintly person. And I thought she would be a good person to advise me on what to wear to such an important occasion. She looked at my choices. I was looking online for something, and she said, no, Andy, no. You mustn't wear one of these businessmen outfits in times like these. And she's very serious. She took my hand. In times like these, the most important show of protest is a defiant expression of joy. Get a red suit. And I take advice when it's given freely. I did it. I wore it last night to something here, I have to say.
Describe this suit for us.
It is, when I'm saying red, you've got it wrong in your head. It's the kind of thing that, like, there's an after image after you look at it and close your eyes. It's so bright. It is a carnelian thing with, like, stripes on the... It's so vulgar. It's absolutely vulgar, and I loved it. I showed up to the ceremony, and by God, everyone was in a gray or a black suit, and it had a double... extra is that there's about 100 people who win the Pulitzer Prize because it's teams of journalists and they take a picture of us all together. You could sure pick me out. And then they played a little joke on, they didn't know it, but they were like, as an extra honor to our winners, we have hired a professional photographer to take photos of you to replace the photo on your Wikipedia page to be the photo for all time to represent you. Feel free later to look up my Wikipedia page. I've got a clown suit on.
Arthur Less, who is the hero, if I can use that term, of the novel Less, which won you the Pulitzer, suits are very important to him too. What is the suit that gets Arthur through many adventures and misadventures?
He's got, it's also a vulgar suit. It's a suit that he ordered in Vietnam, made for him, and he picked out the fabric sort of still maybe in a jet lag haze, and then it arrives in his house and it's much brighter blue than he expects. With a fuchsia interior, it's more blue than the cover of the book in my mind. But he loves it, and he doesn't realize it's vulgar or too much. And so, to me, it's a symbol of his innocence that he can wear it and carry it off, and it looks like confidence because he just doesn't know.
What's going on with him and his life when Les begins?
He's a sort of middle-aged mediocrity, aren't we all? And on the edge of turning 50, single. His ex-lover is getting married. He's invited to the wedding. And in order to neither say yes or no, he answers yes to all the invitations in his inbox to half-baked events that writers get invited to. This is an exception.
What kind of success had he as a writer? Are there parallels with where you were at a certain point in your career?
Yeah, I mean, I had had more success than Arthur, but I think when you're a writer, you don't know where you stand, and some we have some middle child feeling about where you are. He'd published some books and gotten some odd reviews where he couldn't tell if it was a good review or a bad review. I think most of us think our reviews are bad even when they sound good.
He's called a spoonie by one reviewer. What does that mean?
It means sort of an overly sentimental person. It's not a word that I had known before I chose to use it in there. Because I wanted it to be one of those words that in a review, no one knows what it means, but it's really actually mean. The reviewer says he's a magniloquent spoonie.
There is something about him, though, that is so likable. What is the secret of creating a character who has really a series of stuff-ups and humiliations, but that you feel such spooniness for?
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I think I grew to have affection for him. I think his innocence is, I think, an appeal. He thinks for sure it's going to go better next time. He's thoroughly decent to the people he meets, too. Mostly, the only mean thing he ever says or thinks about someone is that they're short.
That can cut.
It can cut, I know. Yeah, I apologize. I feel bad about that one sometimes.
It's such a funny book, Andy. Did it start out as a comedy right from the word go?
I was not previously known as a comic writer. I was known as a wistful, poignant writer. And I was writing another wistful, poignant book about a middle-aged mediocrity, and I worked on it probably for a year and a half, and I hated it. I hated it. I hated the main character. I couldn't feel sorry for him. It seemed to be full of self-pity for someone who actually things were probably going fine with. You know, he owned property in San Francisco, no tears to shed for him. And I couldn't crack it, you know.
So what happened to put a light bulb on in your mind?
I was desperate for any way out, and I go swimming every morning in the San Francisco Bay, which is a different Pacific from yours. It's quite colder, with a writer friend of mine, and it's a time to sort of meditate. And it just occurred to me the only way out was to try something truly desperate, which was to make fun of him instead, make it a comedy, ridicule him. And I started right away, and I had such fun from then on.
As you say, Arthur's preoccupied by turning 50, this sense that life is on its way down. Do you understand his anxiety about aging?
I'm nowhere near 50. I don't know why you would ask that question. I'm 48 years old. It's very far away. I haven't given it a thought. Yeah, I think about it and imagine I have a twin brother. I don't even have to look in the mirror. I'm like, what is happening? What's going on? Why is your hair like that? You know, yeah, I think I've been too boyish too long, and I struggle to figure out how to be even just an adult, much less like super grown up 50-year-old, like supposed to be a normal grown up person. And I'm not the only one who does that.
It's interesting because Arthur in the book feels very comfortable with being young, like everyone who's ever been young has, because that's what you know. And he's also comfortable with people who are quite a lot older. He has an older ex-lover who's in his 70s. It seems like it's this middle chapter that's the one that's really confusing him.
Well, you can tell I'm comfortable with old people too, right? You know, there's something about, I think there's a part in the book where he says that the city of youth and the country of old age, where there's like the excitement of youth and the, you know, partying and that, and then much older where you know what you love, you have this glass of wine and not 17 glasses of wine, you like a sunset, you like this food, and that is enough. And then somewhere in the middle, you're supposed to be some Rockville, Maryland of existence in between the city and country, and it's hard to figure out.
What about the effect that coming of age as a young man in the AIDS epidemic, how has that affected Arthur's sense of growing older?
Well, there was this sort of not a double tragedy, because the first tragedy was tragic enough to live through watching this generation of men older than you dying out by the tens of thousands, and to some of whom have survived and, you know, have vibrant lives, but many of whom died, to live through that and then to reach middle age and realize you haven't had role models. Because all those men died. And there was no generation before that that was out. So you haven't really seen very many gay men get old. And you don't know how you're supposed to do it. I mean, are you supposed to just be like a sort of foam party leather sundae until the end? Or do you stop all that and you go for the you know, glasses of wine in Tuscany and let it all go? And
how are you maneuvering your way between those options?
I buy things at Formica. I don't know. I seem to be heading for a sort of David Niven thing. I seem to be going for a sort of dried up, skinny old age. But my brother's going a different direction, so we'll see which works out.
I think too, Andy, with your mother and that conversation you had in the car outside the mall, you've seen someone in midlife completely transform themselves. Was that a version of a model for you?
That's a smart question. Yeah. Yeah. I watched my mother change absolutely everything with incredible bravery, making huge sacrifices and losing a lot of friends and love and stability. And it was glorious to watch it. And it does give me a sense that there's a second act and then a third act, you know, which I don't think you know when you're young. You're especially when you think of your parents as like fixed, set, until forever. When they change, a lot of people feel betrayed by that. And I luckily didn't. I was inspired by it.
Your father, who is a hero in his own sense, own light in the story that you're telling, has an introduction to your book in another language. Can you tell me about your dad?
Two of them.
What are they?
Oh my God, you have got to look at these. And it's so amazing. My dad speaks fluent German, Russian, Norwegian, and Czech, and he's learning other languages. And he decided he was going to write introductions to, not write, perform these sort of scenes. One is in Norwegian for the readers of Norway, and another one is adorable. It's like a scene in a park where he meets a Czech woman who has a copy of my book, and they speak in Czech about it, and then they ask me questions, and I respond. It's unbelievable.
Do you know what he's saying in these introductions to your novel?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, the Norwegian one, it sounds enough like you're like, I think he says that he is the father of Andrew Sean Greer and the forefather of Arthur Less, or grandfather, I don't know, something like that. It's one of the sweetest things I've ever seen. And it's part of a series he's going to make.
There is so much sweetness in the story of Arthur Less as well. It feels like it's a kind of a joyful tonic that you've given to readers. Did you set out to make a happy book, a happy ending for this slightly hapless Arthur Less?
Yeah, I won't say that I was in the happiest place when I wrote the book, but I think it shouldn't come as a surprise that a comic novel can come out of times of pain in your life. And maybe that's why I was insistent to myself. I wanted to write a book that had a feeling of joy at the end. I had a student who said it couldn't be done. And I said, I'm going to do it. And that was the sort of purpose of the book.
Well, you did it. Congratulations.
Oh, man, thank you.
I'm sad you're not wearing the red suit, but it's been delightful to meet you. Please join me in giving a big round of applause.
And thank you to Sarah.
That was my conversation with Andrew Sean Greer, recorded in front of a very live audience at last year's Sydney Writers' Festival. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.